You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money on this beautiful spring Monday morning. Good morning, Park City. I'm Doug Wells, along with my co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Doug. Happy to see you today.
Yeah, happy to see you. And what a beautiful weekend we had for the closing weekend for the resorts. I hope you got out to enjoy the final turns or whatever you like to do outside, because it sure was beautiful. Allison, were you able to take advantage of any of that?
I did not take my final turns here, but I will. I wish I did. Yeah.
All right. Well, as long as we got outside, that's what matters. And we've got a great show for you today. It's going to be really focused on the financial aspects of our business and personal lives. This morning, our first guest is going to be Cindy Kuyomijan. She's going to join us to talk about her new book, Redefining Financial Literacy, Unlocking the Hidden Forces of Your Financial Future. The book provides a unique perspective of what she calls the hidden forces behind your money.
We're then going to talk with Carolyn Bettino. She is the founder of the Money Empowerment Project and author of Land of Plenty, a solopreneur's guide to finding joy, possibility, and abundance through money empowerment. So Carolyn will join us today to help us work on our money mindset. And then we're going to end the hour talking with Michelle Buxton, a certified financial planner at Albion Financial Group, and she'll talk about the power of IRAs, 401ks, and other tax-deferred plans in helping you to reach your retirement goals.
Research confirms that being more literate in financial topics is positively correlated to an individual's capacity to overcome economic difficulties like we just are going through now with COVID-19 and situations like the 2008 financial crisis. However, financial literacy statistics demonstrates that most individuals do not possess the financial expertise needed to make positive financial choices that will benefit them in the long run.
As a certified financial planner with over 35 years of industry experience, Cindy Kuyomijan is committed to filling the financial literacy void for many Americans. In her timely and thought-provoking book, Redefining Financial Literacy, Unlocking the Hidden Forces of Your Financial Future, Cindy gives a unique macro perspective of what she calls the hidden forces behind your money, which are the unseen political and economic forces that may influence your investment decisions. As the founder of Synergy Financial, Cindy believes that financial literacy is a moral imperative, which is why she devoted her professional life to help people understand the constantly evolving financial and economic landscape. Cindy's passion is to educate people on the importance of better care of their hard-earned money, and she is passionate about inspiring people to believe in themselves and to believe in possibilities. Cindy, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, what is the state of financial literacy in our country, and whose responsibility is it to teach people how to manage their money?
That's a great question. You know, we live in the most powerful economy in the world, yet we have the poorest financial literacy rates. We rank 18% in the world today. You know, and if you look at that for a moment, you think about the pandemic and where people were and how financially unfit they were when the pandemic hit, it comes down to something like this. 60% of people don't have a budget, and 40% of Americans today, across all different socioeconomic levels, feel poor financial literacy. And I really think that problem, as I write about my book, constitutes two sectors, the private and the public. And the public sector, the government only mandates in some states that six states out of 50, think about that for a moment, require one class in finance in high school. While the big financial institutions across this country only spend 3% of their budget. So we have a responsibility, not only the private, the public, and the financial planners across this country, to improve financial literacy to Americans. And how do we do that? You know, in my professional opinions, schools need to start incorporating this in their curriculum. We need to add this to subject matters like math and science, and start the process one step at a time, educating Americans through elementary school, high school, and college. And then I think once people have that amount of knowledge, they can really look at the system and see where there's errors and how this capitalistic system may be broken today.
So, Cindy, we're fortunate here in Park City to live in one of those six states that does mandate financial literacy. Mm-hmm. The high school also does a really good exercise. I believe it's the freshman and possibly also the sophomore year, where kids go through, okay, there's a lottery, you get assigned a job, and based on that, you have to make choices based on what that salary is, right? So the brain surgeon has more money to spend than somebody that's in the service industry, for example. And that just seems like the basic minimum we should be formally teaching our kids. How did we get in this situation that it's not a topic for formal education in our school system?
Well, financial literacy is really broken down into two components. The first component, and there's thousands of books that you can buy, is on the micro. How much should I save? What are the interest rates? What's inflation? What's a basic investment model? How much should I budget? So I think that piece of it has been out there, and there's a lot of books, and there's a lot of information. However, I really think what's missing is the macro side, because when I started writing this book, I could not find a book out there on forces that we have no control over, because the micro, the savings, the investment, and the budgeting is something we as Americans can control. We can decide how much we're going to save. Are we going to set up a budget? And what basic investment strategy are we going to put together for ourselves? But the missing link here is that macro end of it. And I was reading about this back east. A gentleman had won Teacher of the Year in North or South Carolina. I can't remember. He goes, what this country needs is macro financial literacy. But the problem, and in his article he writes, teachers don't even know about the subject matter, so how are they going to teach students? So I think it's just the lack of knowledge at all levels of our economy. And I have an opinion about that. I don't know how financially literate the government has wanted the people to be, because there are other countries that the government mandates, because learning 1 year in high school or even a couple of years is still not enough. We need repetition. We need it in our elementary schools. We need it in the high schools, and we need it in the colleges, and our employers need to reinforce concepts, because the world of finance is so complex and it's always evolving and changing that if you're not getting repetition, you're not understanding the concepts, and you're going at it alone, and what you don't know can ultimately hurt you at the end of the day, because today Americans are responsible for their investments, their retirement. There's limited pensions. Social Security has threats of running out of money. And it's a very scary world for people who use the digital age and Google information and can't transform that information into knowledge. And it's become my passion and my mission to try to get these programs in our school systems, get people educated, not only on that micro, but also add a new component of macro to the equation. And then I think we will have a nation of educated investors that can ask a question. Because if you don't know any information, how are you even going to begin the process? So there's accountability not only from the private, the public, and the individual sector, which is people like you and I.
So, Cindy, you made a bold statement just a minute ago with regards to whether or not it benefits certain people if the population remains financially illiterate. Can you talk about, you know, how we as a society either benefit or don't benefit from people being literate? You know, a lot of times people just look at it as, well, that's my neighbor and that's their situation.
Good point. So, how do we benefit as a nation from becoming more financially literate? And I think the number one thing, and I have a second book coming out next March called Feminine Courage, is reducing inequality in this country. Because as you just mentioned, people who have more sources, have more wealth, have access to information that you and I don't, that will begin to fill the financial gender gap. As that becomes narrow and as women become more financially literate, they can now be in a position in their jobs to get more equality. Because I believe that inequality comes from lack of information, especially financial information, because information and knowledge is power, and power demands change and economic justice across this country to have equal wages. But equality comes from financial literacy.
So let's talk about it sounds like your sense is we're not great, but we're doing okay on the micro level. It's the macro level that we're way behind on. Talk to our audience about what you mean by macro. What are some of those topics?
Okay, the macro level really consists of things that you and I can't control. So think about it for a second. We look at political. We all hear, you know, these millennials are coming. The Federal Reserve keeps printing money. I'm nervous. Is the value of the dollar dropping? Right? I mean, that's the big talk right now. A lot of these YouTube channels are talking. That's political risk. Or our tax rates have been going down for the last 50 years. That's political risk. Because who benefits from low tax brackets? That's not you and me. I was reading something the other day that Jeff Bezos had an $81,000 salary. How does a billionaire pay taxes less than a person who earns $150,000? So political risk associated with the Federal Reserve, you know, quantitative easing, a lot of these YouTubers are talking about printing money, low tax rates cause instability in this country. And then you look at the economic ideologies of capitalism, okay? And this is where it gets a little much in the weeds, but the bottom line here is this, that the government has transferred all the control to corporate America. They buy back their stock. They limit wage increases, capital increases. They downsize. And we've given corporate America a lot of the control in the country to write the laws, make more investment decisions that are risky by buying back their stock. And we all know Boeing had a problem during the pandemic. And they came out and said, hey, we bought back $60 billion of our stock. But now the pandemic occurred. Now we need $60 billion of stimulus. So as interest rates drop, okay, because that's one of the mechanisms the Federal Reserve uses to stimulate. People are buying homes. Big companies buy back their stock. It's a low interest rate environment. It now transfers into you and I, the stock market. Oh, my God, the market dropped 30% in 10 days last year. It affects our money. It affects our anxiety levels. And now you want to retire. Okay, I want to put my money in the bank or in a bond fund. Well, you can't get any interest anymore. Well, why is interest rate so low? Well, when you have a credit crisis in 08 and the dot-com crisis in 2000 and now the COVID crisis, I remember buying my home with an interest rate at 9. I'm refinancing today at 2.3. So interest rates came down not just to help us refinance our house. Interest rates came down to bail out the greed and fraud on Wall Street. And so now it's correlated into society issues such as lower wages, stock market volatility, and how am I going to retire? I got $1 million today and I want interest. I can't even get interest out there. So where macro comes into place, there are other investment choices called alternative investments that can hedge us against political and economic risk that you and I have no control over. People need to get educated today because if they don't and they go with an antiquated 60-40, 60 stocks, 40 bonds, Yahoo Money said last year 40% of Americans are going to run out of money. The writing's on the wall. People need to get educated because there are other investment strategies that the elitists the endowments and the pension have been using for 35 years outperforming the S&P 500. So it's a wake-up call. People need to be accountable. They need to find advisors who are equipped to help them retire comfortably with stability and a peace of mind they can leave a legacy for their loved ones.
So Cindy, I also work in the financial service business. And so when you talk about alternatives, they do have their downsides. So I want to get a little more specific with you. What sure. alternatives are you recommending?
Well, in my book, there's a lot of alternatives. If I was going to write the book for the public, I didn't want to throw in 6 or 8 different alternatives. I wanted to give investors 2 distinct alternative investments that have evolved. I even wrote a chapter on alternative investments in the history, and I go back to the early 1900s, and I started using alternatives in 2003. So that was almost 17 years ago, and those alternatives in 2003 are totally different today. So they have evolved, they've become more institutionalized, and I can pretty much buy a fund that is institutional commercial real estate, to answer your question, that the pensions use these managers to manage their own pension. So commercial real estate's one asset class that I like because of the performance over the last 20 to 30 years. It's outperformed the market. I like the yields that durable income give our clients in real estate. It's a lot more than the 10-year treasury. I like the tax efficiency, and I like the standard deviation. So commercial real estate, using the right structure, the right manager, can add and smooth out the volatility that you may have, because the research is in. You add other asset classes to the 60-40, the research says it smooths out volatility potentially and potentially gives you a higher durable income. So I'm not saying add commercial real estate is going to guarantee you a better outcome. You need to talk to a qualified advisor that has 10, 15 years, who've evolved with alternatives as they become available for Main Street investors. So, the other asset class I like right now. Okay? So it's pretty simple. Commercial real estate, you can buy it as a traded or private. So private or public, and I'm not going to go into discussion of which ones I use and why, but I'm just going to give you a generic strategy that you can add to your overall portfolio. Second, when the market crashed in 08, banks had limitations of who they could lend to. So a new market opened up called non-bank lenders. You can call it private credit. That asset class has really turned on some unique income strategies. Lower volatility than stocks with higher income. So I like private credit, non-bank lending. You can buy it privately or publicly, just like real estate. I'm not here to go into detail there. But I have found that the income from real estate, commercial real estate, not a home, commercial real estate fund managers, adding non-bank lenders, private credit to the equation, that's my second. So I have 2 asset classes I really just talk about outside of stocks and bonds. And there are others, but because there's so much complexity behind it, I am starting to spoon feed the public these strategies so they can ask their qualified advisor a little bit about them and start getting educated.
Yeah. So, both of those are asset classes. I like your advice, which is to talk to a qualified professional because they are complex. Are those examples mm-hmm. of some things that you think our schools should be teaching our young people or that should be on the curriculum for most adults?
Well, I think that's a good question. Alternative investments are like stocks and bonds. It's an asset class. So, yes, that should be taught on the micro level. Because remember, the micro level is budgeting, setting up a budget, setting up a savings plan, and then choosing an investment. So stocks and bonds and alternative investments should be part of the curriculum. But what's missing is that macroeconomic, because if the young people understand what's happening under the hood, both economically and politically, those children will be the game changers in the future in our political and economic system. And if those kids aren't getting the education they need, as much as we want to learn about science and math and grammar, we must teach micro. This is my opinion. If we want the future generations to change the problems that are happening in today's time, real time, societal issues of a system that has been unfortunately favored to the elitists and to the shareholders across this country and the monopolies that have been developed, those things have to be taught for things to change in the future.
I don't know if this is necessarily a fair question as we get to the end of the interview, but when you know you talk about these alternative investment strategies and asset classes, you know, my first thought takes the lazy path of, well, great, I'll just mention that to my financial planner. Like, at what point do I really need to understand this?
Oh, yeah, good. That's very, very important. I think today, I've been in this business 35 years as a female financial advisor. It's been a difficult journey, but it's been amazingly rewarding. Because the bottom line here is after being in the business 35 years, I have finally come to the conclusion. It's not the financial planner itself that needs to be accountable. If you bring yourself in the equation with your financial advisor, both parties must be accountable. What do I mean by that? 5 minutes a day. I'm not expecting my clients to be experts. I've created videos. Hey, did you watch your 5 videos before you come in and see me? Did you fill out your goals and objectives? Your risk profile? I make them spend a couple hours on their own time, because if they're not committed to the process of financial literacy and education, I can't commit to them. I want someone committed. It's like a relationship. If one party's committed and the other party's not, then when something goes wrong or something's misunderstood, there becomes a problem. Open communication, brainstorming, taking a few minutes a day, picking up a book on financial literacy. I mean, I spent 3 years writing this book. For $25, you can now have a macro view of our economy. Yes, Hidden Forces took me 1 year to write chapter one. It was very complex. I rewrote the book 4 times. It's a great read. And I have many more books coming to help the public get engaged, become accountable, and even get the advisor accountable. Because there was a research, Cirelli and Associates said, approximately 7%, listen to this is sort of a staggering statistic, 7% of advisors understand portfolio construction. So that means to me, in my opinion, that approximately 90% of advisors are using a stock and bond model, which, in my opinion, is no longer sustainable for our retirement. And they don't know. Some know a little, some know a lot. And you'll read my journey in my book, why I migrated to alternatives in 2003 and why I now consider myself extremely educated in the area. And my passion came because I didn't want any of my clients to run out of money.
That's a great note for us to end. No financial advisor wants their client to run out of money, so that's a great note for us to end on. We've been talking to Cindy Kuyo-Mijan. She is the founder of Synergy Financial. She's also the author of Redefining Financial Literacy. As Cindy mentions, she spent 3 or 4 years of her life writing the book. You can get it for just $25. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Our previous guests focused on financial literacy and steps we can take to invest and use our money in the best way. But what if you're like me? You read all the books, you listen to the podcasts, and you know that what you're supposed to do, but just taking time to look at my bank account feels like it's the biggest hurdle I've ever taken. Task. But Carolyn Bettino can help us with this. Carolyn is the founder of the Money Empowerment Project and author of Land of Plenty, a solopreneur's guide to finding joy, possibility, and abundance through money empowerment. She joins us today to help us find joy in our relationship with money. Carolyn, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, your book looks at the personal relationships we have with money. While our previous guest talks about the nuts and bolts and what we should know, you really talk about, you know, how we look at money ourselves. Why is that an important place to start?
Yeah, so I actually look at the nuts and bolts as well. My background is as a bookkeeper, and so I'm very nuts and bolts driven. But what's interesting is that I made an assumption when I first started out in bookkeeping that people that had a lot of money must have a great relationship with money, and people who didn't have a lot of money probably don't have a great relationship with money. And after working with over 100 people and their money, I found out that that's really not true at all. And it really comes down to understanding your relationship with money and delving into how and why you interact with money that really transforms your ability to make money and to have a joyful relationship with money. And so looking at that relationship is key in order to really start to unravel all of that fear and guilt and shame that a lot of us feel around money.
So Carolyn, let's start by raising people's consciousness. I think some in our audience are thinking, relationship with money, what does that mean? They've really never consciously thought about it. What do you mean by people's relationship with money?
Yeah, so one of the best ways to think about that relationship with money is think of money as if it were a person. So what would that relationship be? Would it be, this dysfunctional romantic relationship? Would it be a parental child relationship? How you interact with money is a really interesting thing because, like you said, a lot of people don't even think about the fact that they have a relationship with money, but we certainly all do. And we're operating on these ideas that we aren't even aware of. And that has a direct impact in our ability to actually look at our numbers. Like Allison was just saying, that idea of even looking at your bank account feels just overwhelming. Well, that stems back to something that we learned at one point in our life, that it was scary to look at money or that we don't understand money. And so we've got to start with that relationship.
A lot of that relationship comes down to your money story, and you refer to this a lot in the book. Can you give an example of a money story and how that impacts people, how they look at money?
Yeah, absolutely. So the easiest way to show this is to tell my own money story. So I grew up with entrepreneurial parents who both worked really hard. And the messages I always got about money was that you had to work really hard in order to earn money. And while working hard is a great lesson, it also can be a detriment when you constantly feel like you aren't worthy of having money unless you work really hard. And so as I was navigating the first few years of my corporate career just out of college, I worked really hard thinking that that's what would get me ahead. And really, that's not how it all played out in the world. And then after I left the corporate world and started my own business, I continued to work really hard and kept coming up against the same roadblocks. And so that money story of working really hard just followed me job after job and even into my business. And until I really started looking at where that money story came from, I was constantly at this block that I wouldn't be able to get past a certain income level unless I worked really hard. And I had to really step back and unlearn some of those lessons in order for me to move forward in both my joy in my relationship with money and also in my ability to make more money.
So with our previous author, we were just talking about, and I've said this many times on the show, the value of books. I mean, it is incredible that authors spend years researching and writing these books, and for $10 to $30, we get to benefit from all that expertise and time invested in writing a book. And one of the nice things about your book is it has different exercises that you suggest that people go through. And my co-host, Allison, you and I were talking in the green room before. I know this weekend, during the past week, you did some of the exercises. Talk to our audience about that exercise and how it helped you better understand your relationship with money, Allison.
I was lucky enough, I actually joined Carolyn for one of her sessions for the Money Empowerment Project. And again, it goes back to what are those stories you heard as a child? And so for me, it was what were the discussions my parents were having with regards to money? Was it plentiful? Was it scarce? And so in my family, there was a scarcity philosophy with regards to money. And so I think that's why I always tend to neglect looking at my bank account, because again, it's just this feeling that I've gotten. Whatever that number may be, it will trigger scarcity before it triggers abundance. And that's something that Carolyn worked a lot on as far as, you know, mindset goes.
Carolyn, is that a common reaction that people that do your workshop or read your book have?
Yeah, definitely. I think almost everything comes down to fear, shame, and guilt around money, those three emotions. And I think a lot of that is just passed down from generation to generation because we don't have financial literacy in our schools, or we don't really have any education about how to interact with money other than, you know, how to add up numbers. And money is so much more than that. And it's interesting because I work with people that have a huge range of financial socioeconomics. So I have people who are extremely wealthy, and I have people who really don't have much money at all. And those emotions across the board, regardless of how much money you have, are present. And you might feel guilt and shame and fear for very different reasons, but those core emotions are still there. And so, yes, that idea of scarcity is very common. I mean, almost everybody has that fear of there's not going to be enough. So, and it doesn't really matter how much money is sitting in your bank account, but emotions are still there.
How do we get past that? I think we all want to feel this feeling of abundance with our money. But I noticed the three emotions that you talked about, fear, shame, and guilt, are all negative emotions. How do we get past that towards positive emotions towards money?
That's a great question. So I would say that the key is really when you go back and understand where those stories are coming from, and you start asking yourself, are these stories true, or are these stories even mine? Because you might be taking on stories that your parents believed or even your grandparents believed. And so when you really start breaking it down of where those stories are coming from, then you're able to recognize when they come up and replace it with something different. And part of that is also the perception of what's happening, because to me, and what I've seen in my clients, is that when you really focus on gratitude for what you do have and stop comparing yourself to other people or where you think you should be, it really starts to shift your ability to see how much you actually have. And I can give several examples of that, but that's really the key, is the perception of what is happening within your money.
Carolyn, just like with a lot of topics in our society, when we don't talk about them, you know, when they're seen as taboo, it doesn't really help us progress farther and to evolve. Why do you think money is such a taboo topic?
I think that there's lots of reasons that money is taboo, but I think it comes down to one is that it's always been considered rude. There's mixed messages all over the place. So you don't ask somebody, how much money do you make a year? Because you are always taught that that's not appropriate to ask. And many families don't talk about how much money is coming into the family, right? Did you know as you were growing up how much money your parents made? I compare this in my book a lot to sex education, because we don't talk about sex the same way we don't talk about money. And it's just part of life. But I do think that a lot of the reason it's become taboo is because our culture tells us that it's taboo, and those mixed messages come up all over the place. It shows up in religion. It shows up in just our general society. And we just don't have the language or the what we consider polite. And I think some of that is bucking the trend, and having these open conversations about money is what's really going to start to shift some of that.
So, you know, we've got a couple categories of listeners. We've got folks that are listening to this thinking, you know, I need to improve my relationship with money. We also have parents of teenagers or young people thinking, I don't want my kids to have the same issues revolving around money that I do. What advice do you have for parents to help their children have a healthier attitude towards money?
Yeah, a couple of things. The first is to definitely talk about money and talk about not necessarily the troubles you have with money, but just how you interact with money. And then the other thing is to really examine your own relationship with money and your own language you have with money, because a lot of times it might be that you're talking about money in a negative way, but you don't even realize that you're doing it. And it was interesting, as I was writing my book, the first part of the very first chapter of my book talks about my own money story. And as I was writing it, I decided I really needed to make sure that my parents were okay with me publishing this book, because there's a lot about them, obviously, in the book. And it was even interesting as an adult going back and sharing this with my parents and saying, are you okay with me publishing this? It felt really odd because we'd never had a conversation about money like this. And so I think as parents, it's really important to have open conversations with your kids about what money is, your viewpoints about money, and not just coming from you should work really hard in order to make money and that's the right thing to do. Have those conversations about teaching our kids, you know, what money really is and how to interact with that.
Carolyn, I know, you know, a lot of this discussion would mean that people would need to perhaps wake up from what they currently know or believe, you know, about their money. That's one of the more difficult things I think that happened to me, was just the amount of just like seeing a new reality took. And in your book, you talk about The Matrix, the movie, and that's, you know, chapter 4 about breaking out of the matrix. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, The Matrix, I refer to the movie because I feel like a lot of corporate America is like The Matrix. So you graduate from school, from college, or even from high school, and go into the workforce, and you think, I'm going to make such a difference, and I'm ready to go. And then, you know, every time your good idea isn't implemented, or every time you're passed over for a raise, it just kind of starts to crush your soul a little bit. And we all kind of get into this rut where we show up and we do our job because that's what we're told to do, but we don't really think about why we're doing what we're doing. And I feel like money is a lot like that matrix, because when I graduated from college, I felt like I was just plugged into this idea that I could only make a certain amount with the degree that I had earned. And because I had agreed to a certain salary when I started, I was very limited by what my potential was. And it really wasn't until I started my own business and really saw that money truly is this energy that we exchange. You know, if you go back to the very origins of money, it was created because we were bartering. So I'm going to provide you with a service, and in return, you're going to provide me with something else. And instead of just trading those services, we created money. And the matrix really is designed to keep us in this idea that it's very limited. But really, when you think about service, it's truly unlimited. And so is money. So breaking out of that mold and that idea that we are only destined to have a certain amount. And that's a big part of really understanding that relationship with money, is being able to break out and see that there's so much more possibility out there, but we have to be able to see beyond what we think has been created for us.
One of the things that I think is interesting, Carolyn, is your analogy of the Matrix. I like that a lot. This is actually a matrix that most people put on themselves, right? If you want to make more money and you're an entrepreneur, you have to look at the value that your services add and how many people that you're providing that value to. And you can make more money. But as you tell in your story, sometimes we put these self-limiting thoughts on ourselves. And getting out of that mold is really valuable and important. You, in addition to having your book, The Land of Plenty, you also do workshops. Talk to us about those workshops, what they cost, and what types of things you help people with in those workshops.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main one that I do is I do some one-on-one work, but the main group program that I do is called the 21-Day Money Cleanse, and that's the one that Allison went through. And the idea behind it is that you really take the time to focus on what is my money story, how is that money story showing up in my life, and how is it impacting my life. And then once you know what your money story is, you can then put systems into place that support you from what those sabotages might be because of your money story. So going back to my money story, the idea that I had to work really hard, I was very resistant about setting up systems that helped me invoice my clients really easily. And I was also resisting hiring people to help me because I had that story that I had to do it all myself and work really hard in order to earn the money. And once I discovered what that story was, I was able to put different systems in place within my business that supported me. And the thing about systems is that it's not a one-size-fits-all, because it directly ties back to what that story is that you've been telling yourself. And so the Money Cleanse really defines what that story is and what systems you might be able to put into place in order to help you move forward. And it could be something as big as a complete new employee and or billing and invoicing system, but it also might be something teeny tiny, like where you bank, or, you know, looking at your bank accounts on a weekly basis. Because things that I always say is that transformations around your money happen in teeny tiny little baby steps. And I think we often look at the topic of money and it's massive and it feels very overwhelming. And once you get into that feeling of overwhelm, you're not going to really make a whole lot of progress. But if you take one tiny little step, it's going to make a huge difference.
That's a great place for us to end. The journey of a million steps, right, begins with the first step. And if you want to start taking your first steps, we've been speaking with Carolyn Bottino, and she is the author of The Land of Plenty, a book that will help you take those first steps. We continue with our theme of financial literacy and financial topics. I'm in heaven this morning, and one of my favorite topics, nothing better. There's not a better way to start a beautiful spring day than like this. Joining us on the phone is Michelle Buxton. She's a certified financial and senior wealth advisor at Albion Financial Group. That's my company, full disclosure, or the company that I work at. And as far as introduction for Michelle, many of us have heard that this year's federal tax deadline has been pushed back by about a month from April 15th. What this means is you still have time to fund your retirement accounts. Michelle Buxton is a certified financial planner and senior wealth advisor with Albion Financial Group, and she's going to talk to us about IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401ks, and other tax-deferred plans that can help people reach their retirement goals. Michelle, thank you for joining us on Mound Money.
Hi, thanks for having me, Doug.
So Michelle, let's start with, what is a tax-deferred account and why are they important?
Yeah, that's a great question. Tax-deferred account is a type of investment account or savings plan that allows you an immediate tax deduction on the contributions you add and allows you to defer paying taxes on those funds until they're withdrawn in the future, which is most often in retirement or after age 59 and a half. So it allows you to be able to earn on those contributions and not pay tax till later. And this type of account is really advantageous because you don't pay the income tax in the year you earn on those funds, which allows you to save and grow the funds tax-free until you start taking out funds in the future.
So again, just like a quick summary is that, you know, if I'm able to put away these funds tax deferred, that will bring down my overall amount of tax that I pay to the government annually.
That's correct. Yeah, it will allow you to reduce your income in the year that you make the contribution.
And then just as Doug was saying, we get this little extension, yes, prior to filing our taxes where we can go back in time and get to do that and have a count for the previous tax year, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, and really working with an accountant, I do want to put out there that although I'm well-versed in these types of accounts and the rules around them, I am not an accountant, so it's best to work with your accountant on, you know, what those contributions might look like.
Not a problem. So with regards to that, you know, why don't we start about, you know, what limitations would people have if they were looking to put away some of that money to count towards the 2020 tax return? Is there a maximum? You know, what other types of maybe restrictions are there?
Yeah, so if you're putting money away in an IRA or a Roth IRA, if you're under age 50, that contribution limit for this year is $6,000, and if you're over age 50, the IRS allows you to do a catch-up of an extra $1,000, so you're allowed to put away $7,000. And then for those qualified plan contributions, so things like 401k, 403b, you're allowed to put a max of $19,500 in for this year. And also the IRS allows a catch-up on that for those who are 50 and over, so you're allowed to put in a max of $26,000. And then there's also an employer match on top of that. So it's a really great way to be able to save tax-free.
So, Michelle, what's the difference between a 401k and an IRA?
Yeah, a 401k is a plan that allows you to be able to put in a company-sponsored retirement plan that an employee can contribute to pre-tax through payroll withholding, and then an employer can match those, or some or all of those contributions, just like an IRA. So you're able to put more money away in those than you are an IRA. And these types of accounts also grow tax-deferred, both an IRA and a 401k, and are not taxed until you begin taking those withdrawals.
So I think we've all learned a lot through going through COVID, right? It showed us that very unexpected things can happen and can happen quickly. Based on that, how has that impacted the advice that you give your clients?
Yeah. I think we've all learned this year, over the last year, is it's really important to have a safety net outside of these retirement funds, because if you have to draw on retirement funds before age 59 and a half, you can be penalized. There are certain things you can take funds out for, but really building that safety net. So a good rule of thumb is if you're single or a one-income earner family, you want to have at least 6 months' worth of living expenses in a savings account. And if you're married and have two incomes coming in, somewhere between 3 to 6 months of those expenses saved as well. We learned that people really had to rely on these funds depending on the line of work that you were in. Those in the hospitality industry, artists, things like that, you know, had their hours either, you know, diminished or cut. So really having a safety net is something that was really important for this last year.
So knowing that, you know, quite a few, you know, individuals and families have received that that second round of financial assistance through the stimulus checks. When you talk about kind of the best way to save, it sounds like you're recommending, again, to make sure that you've got your rainy day savings plan first before you start really, you know, jumping into your retirement savings. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Having those funds that you can access that are readily available without having a penalty on them, perhaps.
So, Michelle, we've only got a little bit of time left. I want to let you close by asking you, if you could give the general public one piece of advice, financial advising advice, what would that be?
Well, that goes back to savings. So building a savings plan for yourself, really knowing, you know, what income you have coming in, and then getting your mind around what your expenses are. Oftentimes we find this is a hard thing for people to do. You know, they either take too much time or they don't want to do it. You know, don't want to know how much they're really spending. But if you can really understand those two pieces, that puts you in control of, you know, creating a savings plan for yourself. And the earlier you start, the better off you are down the road. That power of compounding really comes into play.
Okay, well, we will leave it there. I am fortunate that my office is very close to your office, and we get to talk about these things on a daily basis. And I thank you for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge with our audience. We've been speaking with Michelle Buxton. She's a certified financial planner and senior wealth advisor at Albion Financial Group. Michelle, great talking to you this morning. Okay, and in addition to thanking Michelle, I also want to thank our sponsors for this show. We couldn't do quality programming like we do without our sponsors, and they include Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
And then we were able to speak today with Cindy Kujo-Yaman with regards to her book, Redefining Financial Literacy. Carolyn Bettino joined us, and she has a new book, The Land of Plenty. And we just finished speaking with Michelle Buxton with Albion Financial. Now, Doug, I received these great little key stats with regards to filing for taxes and, you know, what people feel. And my favorite ones are 38% of Americans would move to a different country, and 27% would get an IRS tattoo for a tax-free future. So you can
sign me up for that tattoo. I would be happy to do that.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.